you have to pick yourself up and not let your ego get the best of you. The passage of time helps. And the older you get, you are able to deal with the toxicities of life just a little bit better because you've seen more of life and you've been able to put things in perspective.
Today we have a legal titan with us, the vice chairman of Winston & Strawn, Mr. Michael Elkin. At his core, he's a problem solver, an expert in IP litigation, also known as intellectual property, with a reputation that rises to the level of Hall of Fame status when it comes to IP. And if you don't believe me, ask Law360 or any other media outlet out there. A Brooklyn Law graduate with over 100 cases tried to verdict, including precedent-setting cases, whether it be strategy, patience, preparedness, or otherwise. I'm so grateful today to welcome to the podcast none other than Mr. Michael Elkin. How are you today, sir?
I am doing great, Jonathan. It's an honor to be with you. Thank you so much for having me participate in your podcast.
It is honestly a pleasure just to hang out with you in this format because I remember when I met you for the first time, I hadn't even applied to law school yet. And seeing someone like yourself who was already so established in the industry, it was like I could see into the future, right? Because I knew what I wanted to accomplish, but to see someone who was already there, it gave it a vision. And so I'm curious from your perspective, what drew you to the practice of law?
Well, this may seem trite, but it is true. When I was a young boy, I was asphyxiated on watching television programs featuring lawyers. Perry Mason comes to mind. Judd for the Defense comes to mind. And I was always very enamored with the sort of control and presence of barristers, as at least depicted on TV and eventually later in motion pictures. And eventually, I was asked in eighth grade what I wanted to become when I grew up. And instantly I said the word lawyer. And I interviewed someone that my family had contact with and wrote an essay on what a lawyer does and the education and training that they have to undergo. And so from a relatively young age, I was sort of starstruck around that profession.
And so what was that process like? You had to study for the LSAT, you had to go through all the different procedures to apply to law school. Once you were admitted to Brooklyn Law, what was your academic career like, and how did you proceed to take the next steps?
Well, let's be clear. My journey was a broken road, just as the Rascal Flatts song would go. While I wanted to be a lawyer from an early age, I took a detour. When I was in college, I decided that maybe the better path for me would be psychology and social work. So there was a moment in time where I wanted to save the world in ways that wasn't necessarily confined to being in a courtroom. So I applied to social work school after graduating college and got in and got a master's in social work. After spending some time working in the world, trying to champion the causes of civil liberties, I decided that that field was dominated by lawyers. And if I was going to do this kind of work, I should go to law school. So I actually came full circle after this detour. And that led me eventually to go to law school and graduate from Brooklyn in 1984. And happy to talk about my career thereafter. But it was a deviated path for a period of time.
So let's dive into that a bit. Could you explain to the audience what you mean?
Well, sure. When I eventually figured out what I wanted to do again, I wanted to do work really in the poverty area and doing work for civil liberties. And I had an interest in politics. I had, for a period of time during the time that I was attending social work school, had a foray in politics. I ran a campaign for a woman that ran for governor in New Jersey back in the early 1980s. And that gave me a taste of politics. And I was interested in doing work, fighting for social justice, and eventually putting my toe into the political arena. And when I was in law school, I took a job in my second year at a law firm that represented a lot of social service organizations, which was right up my alley in terms of what I wanted to do. I worked at that firm as a summer associate and was extended an offer following graduation from law school. And while I enjoyed the work immensely, a lot of the clients that I was working with who were social workers, I was proud to be associated with them. But some of the work did not capture the full range of my attention at the time. And that particular firm, in addition to representing social service organizations, also had a venture capital practice. And I was asked to take a stab at working on one of those commercial cases, and I loved it. And I thought there was no way for me to actually venture into the world of business law. But after that one experience where I felt a thrill and excitement, so I decided to change course.
And with the thrill and excitement, it led you down a path of litigation. What makes for an effective litigator after seeing so many different cases tried to verdict in your own experience and otherwise? What makes for an effective litigator?
I think first and foremost, preparation. You can't really underestimate the importance of preparation. It's the most time-consuming exercise of any litigator. Actually executing in court, it's just a matter of experience and exercising judgment. But unless you're fully prepared, and it's not simply going into the courtroom, it's taking depositions, meeting with clients, negotiating settlements. It's all about really understanding what the facts are, what the range of legal principles are that sort of govern the dispute, knowing about the court, knowing about your adversary, knowing about your witnesses, understanding what the client's objectives are. All of those are facets that really go into becoming a successful litigator, in my view. So that's the most important thing. I think the other things that come to mind are really things that are sort of more tactical. I never like to approach any case unless I understand some core themes that we want to bring out in a case, and to have a really good chronology that gives you a sense as to where to place all of the events of a case on a time continuum, so that you're able to understand sort of the ebb and flow of the underlying circumstances as they've evolved. That becomes a ever evolving blueprint, because you learn more and more facts as you get further into a case, but it gives you a framework. So I would say preparation, a good chronology, and some core themes.
I'm glad you brought up preparation, because I firsthand have had the opportunity to see you prepare. And without naming names or cases or anything like that, I'm sure the audience is very curious, with someone who has an illustrious career like yourself, what are some of the key tactics and preparedness strategies that you implement as part of your skill set?
Well, I think one of the things that you need to do that don't necessarily happen, or it's not as obvious for a younger lawyer, is to know what is it that you need to get out of a deposition. Right? If we're talking about depositions, oftentimes lawyers will approach interviewing witnesses under oath, call a deposition, thinking they need to boil the ocean when very little of that can be used in the actual case, whether for summary judgment or more importantly, for trial. So when I approach a deposition, if I'm taking it, Jonathan, it is to identify what is it from this witness that I really want to extract? What is necessary to achieve? Are there certain points that are important relative to negating their defense or to advancing our claims or advancing our defense and defending against those claims, depending on what side of the V we're on? I also want to make sure that that witness doesn't run amok at trial. So you want to freeze their testimony and understand exactly what they're going to say in response to key questions that are likely to be put to them by opposing counsel at trial. And of course, there are instances where you need to learn the facts that your adversary is going to rely upon. So there is a certain degree of discovery. But I tend to focus most of my deposition preparation and what I need for the particular case, as opposed to just walking aimlessly into areas that I think that the witness may have some knowledge about.
Now, you touched on asking questions, and naturally that's an inherent part of the legal profession. Something we're doing on this podcast and something that we talk about often is the art of asking questions. The better the question, the better the answer. So in your own words and through your experience, could you please share some of the components that you consider make up a good question?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think you've got to be concise. I think if you ask questions that are too prolix and complicated, it tends to create a level of ambiguity or misunderstanding. And so you want to keep it as simple as possible. So a lot of my questions are ones that are readily understood by most lay witnesses and detract from this notion of triggering an objection as to form. So I'm highly conscious of trying to ask a question that will survive the test of time. So ones that would avoid proper objections like being vague or ambiguous or calling for speculation or beyond the scope if the examination is limited in some way, or to assume facts not in evidence, or asking questions of the witness where he or she doesn't have the sufficient foundation relative to having knowledge on a particular subject. But I try to ask a question in a way, if it's interrogation, to marry a witness to the document about which I'm asking the question, if there are documents available. Most of our cases are commercial in nature, so there is no shortage of documentation that is relevant. If you're able to marry a witness to a document where they've actually authored that item of communication, or they've received it or expected to have been copied and reviewed it, it's a lot easier to question them about that document, what they were thinking or what they meant. But otherwise, to start with the proposition of something that they know or reasonably could be expected to know, then to use that and build on those questions. But the most important thing that is necessary in any sort of interrogation, in my view, is to really listen to the answer to the question. Many times, really good lawyers who are smart know exactly what they want to do, but they often think that they know what the answer is going to be. And sometimes if they just listen to the question and deviate from their outline and go down a particular road, it may take them off on a detour, but it may well yield fruit that they hadn't quite thought about. And those are pearls. Pearls in every case is what helps distinguish sometimes winnable from unwinnable cases.
There's also a presence that you carry when it comes to being in the courtroom that, again, I've seen firsthand, or in the boardroom or in client meetings. How would you characterize your presence in the courtroom, in the boardroom, and otherwise?
That's hard for me to say because it would either come across as boastful or presumptuous. I can tell you what goes into my mind when I do make, when I am present. Number one, I think you want to be real because I think phonies can be sussed out rather quickly. If you're inauthentic or if you come across as trying to be someone you're not, I think judges and juries and clients understand that what you're doing is being very contrived and they turn off to that. So I think being real and personable, being real and true to yourself is important. Secondly, I don't think there's any substitute for being personable and being engaging. You want to express, you want to show just as you would someone you want to make an impression with at a meeting, or you want to look the person directly in the eye and express that, you know, you're coming into his or her or their world. So if I'm speaking to a jury, I want to get as close to them as I possibly can, give each and every one of those jurors personal contact. I want to make them feel as if I've heard them, even though we can't exchange words. And then I'm speaking to them, not just with my words, but with my sort of physical way of getting close to them without invading their personal space. And the same with the judge. I think it's very important to build credibility. I don't think you have an opportunity once you've lost it to rehabilitate yourself. You can try. So I think being honest and upfront and direct is very important. There's no perfect case. So there are problems and perils and pitfalls in every one of your cases. I think owning them gives you the ability, Jonathan, to build credibility, and that will get you through some rough times for sure. So I think being honest, having some integrity, being personable, and being yourself are traits that I think are important. I think it transcends performances in court to conveying the messages of being with clients and defining strategy. But the most important thing above and beyond all of this is to listen. You know, listening to your clients, listening to the court, understanding what you perceive to be, what is likely to be questions in the juror's mind from what a reasonable person might conclude if they've just heard what you would expect them to hear. So listening is probably the key attribute, being yourself, being honest, and having some integrity.
The values that you shared just now, I have personally seen you embody in multiple settings. Without naming specific instances, there was a very high-profile case that you had to handle. And I know that doesn't narrow it down, but just for the sake of helping people understand, when you're dealing with high stakes and you have to keep a level head, how do you manage your mindset? How are you compartmentalizing, handling your feelings and emotions to focus on the task at hand? Are there any strategies that you can share with the audience that could maybe help them manage themselves more effectively?
Sure. Well, I mean, I've, over the course of my career, I think I've represented or been adverse to more than 60 celebrities or people of well-renowned stature. And it's very easy to get starstruck. Certainly as a younger lawyer, it's inevitable that you're going to be off balance to a degree. It's exciting because as a young lawyer, it's great cocktail party conversation to say, guess who I deposed today, or guess who my next client is. And oftentimes you can't, from a client confidentiality point of view, share that information. But I think the key to it is to remember that you're a serious professional, and that despite the personal feelings that you may have and the trepidation you might experience in being around someone who is well known to the world, that you're a lawyer and you've got ethical obligations, you've got duties and responsibilities, and to try to be as impervious as you can be to all of the trappings that go into being around celebrities. Celebrities, like anyone else, have their limitations. And one thing about what we do for a living, Jonathan, is there are rules that require celebrities to actually answer questions, for example, if they're your client. So even though they don't want to be in a courtroom, they're required to answer questions and be respectful. I've been in situations where some high-profile clients believe that they don't really have to abide by the dictates of judicial officers, and they learn pretty quickly that they're in a different world, and they're in the court of justice, and they have to abide by the rules of procedure and all of that. But I do think at the end of the day, it's remembering who you are and what you're doing. These celebrities are oftentimes not calling you to hang out with you. You are performing, at least in their mind, a back-end function. You're handling a very serious matter that they'd rather not be dealing with. They'd rather be doing something creative if they're in the arts, or they'd rather be working on business strategies and how to conquer the next foe if they're trying to, someone involved in the tech world. So it's a question of sticking to the basics and not letting your imagination get away from you.
Now, on that note of dealing with high octane personalities, you've also had the opportunity to distinguish yourself in the form of setting precedent. Now, we mentioned earlier at the top that your expertise is in IP. I don't want to speak for you. If I'm mistaken, please correct me. However, you've had the opportunity to be a part of some landmark cases. And I'm curious what it means to you to set precedent and to become a standard within the legal industry and to have that written in the law books.
Well, there was a point in time when I was in my area, which is primarily copyright, where I was representing content owners and was fortunate enough and honored to be able to represent some very important content owners in the music, television, motion picture space for the most part. And while we were getting our fair share of opportunities, I felt at the time that we were not getting the cutting edge or bleeding edge types of disputes that were sort of pitting the interests of Silicon Valley against Hollywood in what's referred to as the digital media revolution, really in the 2000s. And I thought if we could use our expertise in copyright and our knowledge of the entertainment industry for companies that were engaged in digital distribution or who were investing in new technologies related to digital distribution, we might have the opportunity to represent those companies in more landmark cases. So we took a shot somewhere around the mid-2000s on a couple of cases, and we're fortunate enough that the experiment worked and we were able to be fortunate enough to get retained and to be able to work in a way to extend the boundaries of copyright law in the digital media world. And that success sort of led to other opportunities. And we've been fortunate to be able to work with clients in and around the tech sector when they are dealing with challenging licensing or copyright related challenges.
We've outlined a lot of your success here so far, and I'm going to humbly ask you to point to failure, because as we know, we learn more from failure than we do success. In your career, Are there moments that you can reflect on that maybe a young lawyer out there, if he knew or she knew some of those lessons, they could maybe avoid some of those pitfalls? Can you maybe think of one or two instances and the lessons that you learned and just share some of those insights with us?
Sure. Failure is a part of what we do. And it's a question, this is, again, perhaps trite, but it's not whether you experience failure, but it's how you deal with it, how you get back up on the horse in a proverbial sense and move forward. There are lawyers that are fond of saying, I've never lost a case. If that's true, that's very, very, they're extremely talented, much more than me. But you can't handle a great volume of cases without sometimes coming in second place. It's just a fact of life. And you have a choice of coiling and giving up, or, you know, doing something like just buying and working on a farm, or you can pull yourself up. One of the great things about my life is that I had some good role models in terms of my parents, and especially my mother, who's still living, 97 years old. And she was always fond of saying, never give up. And that's sort of what I would say that has helped me through the course of failures. I would say that if we suffer a setback in court, whether it's at summary judgment, a trial, an appeal, there is no shortage of other opportunities. One thing about the legal system, it's very, very forgiving. There are so many different ways to restart and recalibrate and re-engineer opportunities. At the end of the day, it's really not about egos and whether we win or we lose. It's really about the client and objectives. What is the client's objective? Do they want to advance a particular business position? Do they want to win in court because that's their business objective? Do they want to not fork over a sum of money or to be able to regain a sum of money? Do they want to have a competitive advantage? Understanding what a client's objective is really what it should be all about. And so even if you suffer a setback, your ego may be bruised. You may feel embarrassed professionally, or you may feel miserable for a few days. But at the end of the day, it's not the end in terms of being able to represent your client and to figure out the ways in which you can rejigger the chess pieces on the board in order to advance your position. So you have to be resilient. You have to pick yourself up and not let your ego get the best of you. And when all of that, when all else fails, it really, the passage of time helps. And the older you get, and I'm older now considerably than probably anybody watching this podcast or listening to this podcast, you are able to deal with the toxicities of life just a little bit better because you've seen more of life and you've been able to put things in perspective.
And that perspective, I imagine, has shaped your worldview into the point where, like I also was saying at the top, you're the vice chairman of Winston & Strawn. And there's a leadership element that comes along with that, and obviously a gravitas. So my question is, what is your leadership style, and do you see it being effective as the legal landscape changes? Do you find that you'll have to adapt your style as the legal landscape changes?
Well, you know, I think we don't operate, you know, no law firm operates in a vacuum. I think we just like every business, there's an industry and a sector. And so you have to be highly cognizant of the industry in which you find yourself. I think the thing that's probably, there's an external and an internal aspect to the job that's really important. Externally, we're engaged in a war for talent, and you really want to find the very brightest minds and the most talented lawyers anywhere in order to make your particular firm, I'm not just speaking of mine, but really any law firm, be as strong as they possibly can be. Because at the end of the day, the clients that we want to attract and that other law firms want to attract are looking at the depth and breadth of expertise in areas that are going to be important for them to turn to you for your expertise. Internally, there are important facets of management that are key. I think we have an evolving landscape. What worked in the 1980s is very different than, you know, what's going to work in the year 2023. There are generations of lawyers that don't necessarily obtain and digest information the same way. They don't necessarily interact with colleagues the same way. We've all been affected by COVID. And so the notion that we're even having this communication over an internet protocol as opposed to being in person has become more commonplace and more accepted. So I think you need to understand what it takes to motivate your workforce. I think there are certain aspects of management that transcend any business. You have to be conscious of the competitive elements, the cost structure, of course, compensation. And in our profession, at least, nobody is signed to any restrictive covenants in the United States. So as they say, everyone to a degree is a free agent. So you have to recognize that and the ways in which you actually try to motivate, retain, promote, and involve your workforce in work opportunities.
I'm glad you brought up retention. That's definitely something I thought we could touch on if you're comfortable. You mentioned a few different strategies in terms of adapting to the legal landscape when it comes to young talent. What about retaining that talent? There's obviously this notion where we can compensate to a certain degree, right? But when it comes down to it, arguably we're renting that talent, right? Because if they're only driven by the financial aspect, then they're not really in it for the mission. So from your perspective, what does it take to retain top talent in this type of competitive market?
Well, I'm speaking for myself personally, for me, it boils down to two things. One, I think you have to make the job, and it's not indigenous to law practice. I think it permeates any enterprise today. You have to make your place of work compelling. It's got to be a great place to work with great people and with great opportunities to do the work you want to do. So I think the idea of individuals being satisfied with their job or lawyers, they want to make sure they are working with great people, the brightest and the best, that they have specific cases or deals or matters that are exactly what they want to do. And they're in an environment, a physical environment, if they're not reticent to come back to work and find it attractive. I think the second most important thing is their relationships with their superiors. I think most workplace research will show that the extent to which an employee, or in the case that you're asking me about, a law firm, has a good relationship with his or her superior, that bodes really well for retention. They'll feel as if they're connected to the firm or connected to their company because they believe that someone is looking out for their interests and they're comfortable with that person. So in short, it's really having opportunities that the employee wants or the lawyer wants working with people that they respect, being in an environment that is consonant with their ethos, and having a really good relationship with their senior colleagues.
We've talked about your leadership style. We've talked about retention, your background, and...
This episode is brought to you by Slate Milk. Slate Milk is a protein chocolate drink that gives you all the necessary energy after you have finished a hard training session, or also serves as an awesome snack, whether it's hot or cold. I commute 2 hours a day to my job, and every single day after I train, I'm looking for a quick snack or post-workout drink that I don't have to spend time making. So I go into my fridge, I take out my Slate, and I hit the road as fast as I can and enjoy my drink on the way to work. That's the way that I personally like to enjoy it, because there's so many different flavors. So in the morning, the mocha flavor with the caffeine definitely hits. I can also recommend you check out their other flavors. It is a phenomenal brand. They are the number one partner of the UFC. You can actually go to their website, slatemilk.com, type in the code INSPIRED for 10% off your first order. So go ahead, type in the code INSPIRED at slatemilk.com to get 10% off your first order today. This episode is brought to you by ProMix. ProMix is an energy supplement brand that provides a whole plethora of different products, from protein cereal bars to protein shakes, probiotic, prebiotic, deep low products, along with electrolytes, and the list goes on. ProMix is the supplement that I go to for all of my health needs. It has been a game changer for me over the last few months. After the 1,000 pull-up challenge, my immune system was compromised in ways that were super uncomfortable. I kept getting sick, and I knew I needed to level up my game. I didn't place enough value on supplements, but I do now. I spent some time, I did my research, and ProMix is the brand that I decided to work with because my immune system is finally in check. So go check out ProMix.com and type in the code INSIDETHEINSPIRED to get 20% off your first order today. That's right. Go to ProMix.com to get 20% off your first order today with the code INSIDETHEINSPIRED.
I'm curious, what do you see for the future of the legal industry right now? Artificial intelligence, and namely with language models and your background and intellectual property, copyright in specific, it's got a lot of different elements that are kind of tenuous right now. And I'm curious where you see things going. Even I know it's an overbroad question, but I'd really appreciate your feedback on where you see the legal landscape kind of shifting professionally and substantively.
It's a great question. It is a broad question. I could speak an hour to this. I won't. I'll try to summarize it. I think generative AI is going to be transformative for this profession, as it is for all of our clients, and will transcend every industry sector. It used to be a point in time where we'd worry about issues related to confidentiality and reliability. But when there are times, when the clients say, we want you to use generative AI, we're prepared to consent to all of the trappings, then you know you've got to lean into this and figure out ways to address those concerns and those needs and those instructions, of course. So I think all law firms are digging into generative AI in ways that I'm not quite sure, again, speaking personally, whether I thought this would have come quite as quickly as it has. I think secondly, the legal services themselves, are lawyers the only ones that can provide this information? We're seeing a lot of alternative legal suppliers that have cribbed the opportunities of at least certainly of major law firms. And so there are those disruptive aspects out there as well. I think the war for talent is raging, And as I mentioned earlier, I think there are, competitive forces at play, and there are infinite resources of other firms, for example, that based on trying to attract talent in a particular area, will just do what they need to do in order to, poach talent. And so there's a need to get to be just as nimble. I think while this has been exaggerated in the past, I don't think there's any notion that there'll be further consolidation in the market. I think conflicts, of course, have played a role to an extent related to the extent to which, law firms can combine. Again, just speaking from a personal perspective, based upon what I know about the industry, I think the cost of technology is going to go up considerably. And I think that's going to drive, that's going to create efficiencies in terms of the deployment of technology, but I think the cost is going to rise. And I think the overall cost of running firms is going to be a lot of pressure to reduce them and achieve efficiencies. Real estate is an obvious example, given the notion that people can work more remotely, as we sort of alluded to earlier. So there are many others, but those are some of the challenges that I see in the forefront.
Michael, I've had a really great time today, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know how valuable it is, as is mine. And I have one final question for you, and it's one that I pose to all my guests. If the future version of yourself, assuming he's in that ideal spot 10 years from now, were to fly in and offer you some advice in order to get there, what do you think he would say to you?
Again, it's another great question, and I hadn't thought about this. I would say, listen to your heart. It's tough. It's a very, very tough profession. It's very time consuming. That notion that we heard about in law school, the law is a jealous mistress, is true. Since it takes so much of your time and effort, you really want to spend your life as a lawyer working in an area that you really love and something that makes your blood boil. If you do that, you won't regret the amount of time that you put into this profession and your calling, because you know that at least is consistent with what you want to do. I think one of the great things about being a lawyer in general that attracted me at the very beginning is that lawyers generally, not always, but generally, you can make a reasonably good living and have decent job satisfaction. But if you're able to find something in the law where you're passionate about and that really makes you want to get up every morning, as I've felt blessed to be able to do every day, and really love your job and want to attack it, then you know you've gotten into the right space. So I think it requires some soul searching. It's not an epiphany that you'll have. It's really more of a feeling that you know that you've landed and you've arrived at the right spot.
Michael, I've had such an awesome time knowing you. Look forward to continue to knowing you. Please let the audience know where they can keep up with your journey.
Thank you. Well, I'm here, reachable any time of day or night. And feel free to look me up if you wish. But in the meantime, it's really been an honor to spend time with you, Jonathan. And if I were interviewing you, I would be returning in spades all of the accolades that you so graciously have called me out for. So thank you for being a wonderful protege, a great friend, and somebody who I look up to and admire.
I appreciate you more than I could say. Thank you so much.